This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, John Pilger joins us to talk about Julian Assange's situation at the Ecuadorian embassy.
The WikiLeaks publisher has had his internet connection cut off, and he's been denied visitors or communication. John Pilger is perhaps the great journalist in the English-speaking world. Pilger knows Assange, he's interviewed him, he's written about him, and we're pleased to have him as our guest.
We also learn about copyright law in a variety of creative mediums.
This economic system discourages creative artists, particularly when what they do is stolen. Let's hear about how to protect them.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
2 weeks ago, WikiLeaks founder and internet publisher Julian Assange, who's holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, had his internet access cut off due to pressure by the British and American governments on tiny Ecuador. Ecuador had granted him political asylum in their embassy, where he has been living in two small sunless rooms for 5 years. Ecuador gave him political asylum after he sought refuge in the embassy to avoid extradition to Sweden, which would have sent him to the United States. Assange was under protracted investigation for a rape claim made up by the Swedish police and Swedish prosecutor and denied by the purported woman victim. Sweden finally dropped the case, but Assange remained subject to arrest in Britain for jumping bail. Assange and WikiLeaks had been steadily revealing the war crimes and illegalities of the American government since it first published the Iraq war logs 8 years ago. The war logs included video footage of American soldiers assassinating Iraq civilians from a helicopter and killing a Reuters journalist. Chelsea Manning, who was recently released after 7 years in prison, furnished WikiLeaks with the war logs. The United States government is seeking to capture Assange and bring him back to the United States to stand trial for espionage, a crime which carries the death penalty. Here to speak with us today is Assange's fellow countryman, the Australian journalist, filmmaker, and author, John Pilger. Pilger has written about Julian Assange and interviewed him several times.
John Pilger, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Nice to be back.
John, would you agree that what is at stake in the Assange case is the freedom of a publisher to publish what it is given and the freedom of readers to read that material?
Yes, basically, that's the principle that is at stake. There are other principles as important, such as the basic human rights of an individual, as Julian Assange's human rights have been so contravened over the last 8 or 9 years, that really the two issues go together. But yes, it is about freedom of speech, and the cutting off of communications to Julian in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, the installation of a blocker that prevents internet access, prevents telephone, and the denial of visitors are going to the heart of the matter, actually on both principles. The heart of the matter on freedom of speech and of Julian's own human rights.
For listeners who may not be as tuned in to the case as we are, why is the U.S. so doggedly determined to get its hands on Julian, and what did he do specifically?
Well, I think it's about time Americans answered that, isn't it? If you're all wandering around in a fog, still asking, excuse me, but still asking yourselves that, my goodness.
Well, there may be a few unenlightened few. Well,
the United States' dominance in the world is threatened. Why is it about to attack Syria? Why is it provoking Russia? Why is it provoking China? They're all connected, and connected very intimately with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks has revealed to those who want to know the reasons for the United States behaving the way it does. The United States is an imperial power whose dominance has been seriously challenged. History is full of these situations, but never before have we had the imperial power and two of its rivals, though not military rivals, but two of its rivals, nuclear armed. That's the issue here. Above the principles that we've talked about, freedom of speech and human rights, the real issue here is survival. I find it astonishing that the media in so-called free countries continues to be led down cul-de-sacs and about U.S. intentions. There is the real threat now of nuclear war, and there are clearly people in Washington who are prepared to take that risk. Julian Assange has presented, with WikiLeaks and individually, an opposition to that, and a very coherent opposition to that, because he and his organization and the whistleblowers that have served it have provided information that the public has a right to know, information about the way wars begin, the lies that begin them, information about how senior government officials, say like Hillary Clinton, are connected to the sources of organized jihadism in the Middle East. So what Assange and WikiLeaks has done is what true journalists ought to be doing, giving the public information. The public have a right to know, but they're not being told. They're being told a great deal of repetitive propaganda, but the basic information is not there.
As attorneys, Heidi and I and the late Michael Ratner, who was our co-host and who was the attorney for Julian Assange, we all suspect that one of the charges that would be brought against Assange is conspiracy to commit espionage. Conspiracy is a charge that's called by defense attorneys here as the darling of the prosecutors because it does not require proving of a crime, merely the intent to do a crime. In the Pentagon Papers case, the New York Times and other newspapers were not prosecuted for publishing the Pentagon Papers because they were passive recipients of what Daniel Ellsberg gave them. Are you afraid that the United States government would try to convict Julian by asserting that he conspired with Chelsea Manning to get the Iraqi war logs, or that he conspired with Russia to publish the files of the National Democratic Committee?
You're absolutely right, and you know better than I as a lawyer. Conspiracy is the great catch-all, and it can be used at almost any level of prosecution for the authorities to finalize a case, to successfully prosecute. I understood the most likely charge that would be brought against Julian would be espionage, which I always bemused Julian and certainly bemuses me and says a great deal about American thinking in the world. Julian is not an American. He owes no allegiance to the United States. Therefore, how can he be charged with espionage? Even some of the possible conspiracy charges, they relate to Americans. The assumption, of course, is that we are all Americans. Oh, yes, that's a very serious assumption, and it certainly applies to Julian Assange. And that assumption is translated into the behavior of the great multinationals like Twitter and Facebook, and the power they have to manipulate and across borders. I think your question is a good one, but really I don't think the law has much to do with this now. This is, the hunt to get Julian is a political one, and the law will be fashioned to that political need.
The Espionage Act was first passed during World War I, and it was used by the government to go after people who were opposing the war. It was America's first imperial war. And the first person to be tried and convicted and imprisoned under the Espionage Act was the great Eugene V. Debs, who spent several years in prison, actually ran for president as a prisoner. But he was put in prison under the Espionage Act. It's ironic that 100 years later, they want to use it again against another great anti-war figure.
But he's not an American.
Yeah, I know.
He's not an American. He, you know, that was America's war. Julian, I find that so telling. You know, a charge of espionage should be leveled against somebody who is not an American, who doesn't owe allegiance to the United States. And I do, and I'm sorry, I would not quite agree with you saying the First World War was America's first imperial war. You've left out the Spanish-American War and all those through the 19th century. But putting that aside, the pursuit of Julian Assange is to silence him and to silence WikiLeaks. There is a vindictive edge to it as well. And as you, both of you, would know much better than I, there is that vindictive edge to the law, and I find it particularly in the United States. And this is to silence Julian, to shut down WikiLeaks forever. That's the aim.
John, speaking of the United States, you know that Julian remains a controversial figure here, even among the left. We hear various...
what's the left? Excuse me. I really object to that term, the left. People calling themselves the left in the United States are usually anything but. That is, if we're talking about a principled opposition to multinationals and globalism and all the rest of it. So I'm sorry, I can't accept a question like that that rather needs deconstructing. One of the real problems we have is that the opposition barely exists. The opposition to these grave developments that are leading us to the real prospect of a world war is not there. It's missing. And that the supporters of the obsession with Russia, Russiagate, Russia poisoning, anything, the weather, whatever, the most obsessive supporters of this come from the so-called left. And that's the problem. There is no opposition. There's no opposition to events in the Middle East other than occasionally opposing Assad. No opposition to Israel. Just no opposition. The great movements in the United States, the great freeze movement, the great anti-war movements, are all in the memory. There's nothing like them today, and we need them more than ever. So when you say to me, Julian is a controversial figure among members of the left, yes, he's a controversial figure because he opposes what they support.
Beautifully put. I think Michael and I totally agree. Let me rephrase that. There are allegations that Julian helped Donald Trump get elected president, and we're curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, what's the matter? I think we probably would have gone to war earlier, but that's just rather trivial speculation on my part. I've been writing from and filming in and living in the United States for many years. What's it matter? Hillary Clinton was probably the most accredited warmonger that any presidential race has produced. That, I mean, she was the embodiment of the system. Trump is a caricature of the system. That's the only difference. Now, there may be other differences, I don't know. We didn't have a Clinton administration. But anyway, that the allegation that Julian set out to help Trump is about as baseless as the Russians set out to help Trump. And a Republican-dominated Senate and committee has put paid to that, although you wouldn't know it reading the media. But it's the same thing. It's nonsense. He never did that at all. Although I think some of the most significant WikiLeaks releases were the John Podesta cables, which showed a direct connection between the Clintons, the Clinton Foundation, and the source of organized jihadism in the Middle East through to Saudi Arabia. I think that was information that people needed, and it wasn't leaked with any particular political motive in mind. Certainly not that I'm aware of. WikiLeaks, you know, WikiLeaks has leaked on all sides. It's leaked something like 800,000 documents on Russia. Most of them not very friendly to Russia. Many of them used in court cases against Russian authorities. It's leaked about Trump. It's leaked about the Democrats, and it's leaked about the Republicans. There's the expression, wood for the trees. I suggest that, going back to your initial remark, why is all this happening? It's happening because there is a civil war going on within the U.S. establishment between the forces of Trump and the Democratic Party-supported forces, CIA, State Department, and others. But otherwise, it's business as usual. It's business as usual. It was heading this way through Obama's time, and here we are now at an extremely dangerous time.
What did the release of the Democratic National Committee documents demonstrate about Hillary Clinton's connection with ISIS and with her connections, her foundation's connections with Saudi Arabia and Qatar?
Well, they showed that Clinton knew. They knew that she was taking, the foundation was taking huge amounts of money from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And at the same time, in fact, before the foundations accepted money from these two states, Clinton herself made it clear in private emails that she was fully aware that these two states, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, were the main supporters, the main funders. They were at the back of the creation of ISIS. She knew that. And yet, she not only, her foundations not only took vast amounts of money, but as U.S. Secretary of State, she was largely responsible for pushing through the biggest arms deal in recent American history to Saudi Arabia, one of the funders of ISIS. Saudi Arabia, which is one of the backer of this present jihadist misery in Ghouta in Syria. Those two states have always been, especially Saudi Arabia, have been very important to American power in the region, and especially important to the Clintons. So this was important information. You must remember that what WikiLeaks releases is not something that appears in the newspapers or on television, on radio. It is real news. It tells people how the system works, and the reaction, I would have thought, confirms that.
John, Julian told you that Ecuador's granting him asylum was a brave and principled thing to do. Ecuador now has a different president. Do you fear they might revoke his asylum?
I don't see how they can. Again, I'm always cautious about speculating on matters I don't know about, and I don't know about this. I don't see how they can. I think before we are too perhaps harsh on Ecuador, they are under extraordinary pressure. It was, and this new government, the new president, Lenin Moreno, is no particular friend of his predecessors' granting of asylum to Julian Assange. Perhaps it was a coincidence, but I doubt it, that just as they were cutting off communications to the embassy in London, the deputy head of the U.S. Southern Command arrived with a delegation in Quito to discuss the Ecuadorian military returning to the fold. This is a small country. I think its population is something like 16 million people. What it did before was quite incredible, really. And what has happened now is almost inevitable. Though I can't, in answer to your question, I can't see how the Ecuadorian authorities can simply take away a political asylum that was granted as a process, as an international process. You must remember, this was not simply a gift from the Ecuadorian government. It went through a whole international process and had to comply with a number of conditions, many conditions, for political asylum. And when Julian's case was completed, it was studied, and a decision was made, and indeed it had complied. And, you know, this has been well and truly confirmed by international bodies, the United Nations Working Party on Unlawful Detentions makes this clear, that Julian is unlawfully, as it were, detained. And it did so after a long examination to which the United Kingdom was a party. So that's a roundabout way of answering your question. The answer is I don't know. You know, I think if they did attempt to do something like that, the opprobrium that the government would receive, especially within Latin America, would be disastrous for them. Mm-hmm.
We have just a few minutes remaining, John. What would happen if Julian were to walk out of the Ecuadorian embassy?
He'd be arrested by a London policeman and taken to prison and brought before a judge and to answer a prosecution of skipping bail. I mean, that's what would happen. But during that period, he would be incarcerated for some period of time, and that would give the United States the opportunity to bring an extradition order against Julian. But that's going to be difficult. That's going to be difficult. Julian has a very formidable legal supporters, not least among people like yourselves over there, and one of his legal people has said, we will keep that in the courts to the end of time. Now, whether they're able to do that, I don't know. That sounds pretty awful, but the battle isn't over yet. But that's what would happen, in my view. I don't know, in my view. You must remember that even if Julian tried to go to hospital, he's been told, I think, that he would be allowed to go to hospital, but there'd be no guarantee that he'd be allowed back. And he's actually in need of examination, like x-ray examination. it's reached a very cruel stage. This is cruel and unusual punishment now, a kind of form of torture, sensory deprivation, if you like, cutting somebody off from all the communications with the outside world. For a man who has actually exhibited only extraordinary courage and has done a public service with few parallels.
Well, although the West and the United States in particular claims that it has no political prisoners, obviously that's what's happened to Julian. What do you think people here should do and can do to support him?
Well, where do you begin? I said a little while ago I didn't think there was any opposition, real opposition, in the United States. It was bound up with so many distractions. But as far as Julian is concerned, this is a very specific issue of free speech. People should be demanding that, for instance, the media tell the truth. That's a that's a pretty tall order, because where would they start? But tell the truth about Assange and WikiLeaks, because what has happened to Julian Assange could happen to them. The Clinton emails were first published in the New York Times. No one has been pursued or prosecuted on the New York Times. The Iraq and Afghan war logs, which WikiLeaks published, were first published in New York Times and El Pais and The Guardian. No one on those newspapers has been prosecuted. I think what people should do is demand that journalists support journalists themselves, if not their organizations, journalists themselves support Julian, that lawyers support Julian. This is about the law. This is about right and wrong. And then a wider public campaign is needed. But there's been so much misinformation about Julian. As you know, time and again, whenever it was reported, it was saying he'd been charged with rape. He was never charged with anything. And that the whole Sweden case was bogus and collapsed under the weight of its absurdities. And we now know from a Freedom of Information finding that the Crown Prosecution Service in London tried to stop the Swedes withdrawing the case back in 2013. The Swedes wanted to get out of it. There's been so much injustice here that I think lawyers should be involved. I think anybody who cares about justice and injustice and our basic rights should be involved. If that doesn't stir a public movement, then we're lost.
John Pilger, you know Julian, you've interviewed him, you write about him frequently. We encourage our listeners to just Google John Pilger and Julian Assange, and they'll get the latest updates on his situation. Heidi and I thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, John.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, John. You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Laws protecting artwork and intellectual property are increasingly being put to the test amid claims from rising artists marketing their work online, whose work is being copied by others. So-called art piracy can include music, posters, clothing design, book cover art, signage, record sleeve art, and typography. Under copyright law, one artist using another artist's idea is generally legal, while one artist using another's expression of that idea is generally not legal. Only a fact-intensive analysis can provide clarity, and even that is subject to a judge or a jury's review. Sometimes copyright cases expand into major litigation. For example, a New York judge recently ruled that graffiti or aerosol artists were entitled to a $6.7 million verdict after New York developer Gerald Wolkoff destroyed their well-known public work. The claim in the so-called Five Points case arose under the Visual Artists' Rights Act, or VARA. It's the kind of case that attorney Scott Burrows says rarely goes to trial. Several artists created aerosol art pieces on the walls of an abandoned development in the once downtrodden, now gentrified neighborhood of Long Island City, Queens. Wolkoff destroyed their art as part of a development plan. Joining us now to talk about this and other art-related cases is attorney Scott Burrows, an advocate for artists' rights who curates the art law blog You Thought We Wouldn't Notice, and who has a weekly copyright law column on the legal website Above the Law. Scott, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Michael and I were just talking in the studio about the creative process, specifically as it relates to folk music, because Michael's son is a folk musician. And we wanted to ask you if you could give us an example in which a judge or a jury found that one artist, in whatever medium, unlawfully used another person's idea or expression.
Absolutely. I can give you a recent example from a trial that we conducted before a jury here in Los Angeles in December. In that case, our client was a fashion designer, and the law in the United States is somewhat unique when compared to the law of other creative or countries that are known to have strong creative histories like France or Italy, where in the United States, the copyright law does not cover the silhouette or the cut of a garment. So if a designer creates a beautiful over-the-shoulder gown that's worn on the red carpet one night, it's absolutely within the law for someone to copy that, the cut of that garment, the very next day and sell it to the public without any sort of repercussion. There is an exception, though, to the general rule that fashion is not copyrightable, and that is that textile designs and embroideries and lace designs are copyrightable, the idea being that artwork of that nature is two-dimensional artwork that can be separated from the garment and exist and live its own artistic life. So we have a designer client in Los Angeles who created one of these original textile designs that it marketed to its clients for use on fabric. The international retailer H&M somehow got a hold of that design and incorporated it into a number of H&M garments that H&M then sold to the public. Our client discovered this and sent to H&M a cease and desist letter that indicated, listen, this is our artwork, you're using it without our permission, you've bought it from a source that's not authorized, please cease and desist. H&M ignored that cease and desist demand and kept selling this product until they sold out of their inventory. So we took this case to trial before eight jurors here in Los Angeles, and our designer took the stand and gave testimony as to the story she was telling through her artwork, as to how she created the various elements and motifs that comprise the artwork. And H&M presented its defense, which was that an individual who did not appear at trial in China had created their artwork. And the jury considered the evidence and most likely took into account the fact that H&M presented no witness to testify about this alleged creation, and they found H&M liable for willful copyright infringement and awarded over $840,000 in damages against H&M.
Nice going.
It's fascinating. I never thought of this applying to clothes. We know that, for example, when young royalty in the United Kingdom come out with a new dress or a coat, you often see them flying off the racks. And as you say, a chain like H&M that's more affordable often imitates those. But it never dawned on me there would be lawsuits about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I mentioned earlier how the United States doesn't cover the silhouette of a garment. And it's a quirk in our copyright law that goes back to the days where the United States was not a creative powerhouse, at least in terms of fashion, and our fashion industry was comprised of mostly copyists, people in shops primarily in New York at the time that would look to Europe to see what were the trends and what were the new designs of the day and would simply copy those and then sell them in the U.S. market. The Copyright Act said that was not a violation of the Copyright Act because the clothing items were functional. They were utilitarian. They didn't really express anything creative. They were there to keep us warm and protect us from the elements. Now, of course, things have changed. There are many garments I'm sure you can think of that are primarily creative and that aren't exactly functional, form over function over form. But that's still the state of the law today, despite attempts by designers to modify that to allow them some limited protection.
Scott, in your practice, is there one art form that you deal with more than others? For example, music or visual two-dimensional design, as you referred to. What's sort of the most popular format that's appropriated by other artists?
We deal with artists and content creators across all media. I would say that there is a lot of activity in the two-dimensional artwork space, whether that be a fabric or fashion design, or whether that be graphic artwork. The ability of copyists to obtain two-dimensional artwork online and make reproductions of it and then sell it on product is easy today because of the internet. If I have a graphic artist client that releases a series of buttons or patches on its website or post it on its Instagram account, the copyists can access it that day and then make their knockoffs and ship them worldwide. So we're seeing a lot of that right now.
Can you talk a little bit about the Lil' Kim zombie face artwork case?
Absolutely. That case was unique because it addressed a type of artwork that is somewhat non-traditional, and I can say that non-traditional art is another growing and emerging area of copyright law. When you think of copyright, you may think of books or paintings or more traditional media, but a lot of the activity in the copyright space right now is more non-traditional media, such as makeup design, such as tattoo art, such as aerosol or street art, types of artwork that is, you know, one may not think of when they think of copyright law or the Copyright Act. The Lil' Kim case was fascinating because our client had created a very striking and very compelling zombie makeup that she had posted on her Instagram account. And the Copyright Act says that one gets a copyright in their work as soon as they fix it in a tangible medium. So once you write something down, once you apply makeup to a face, you gain a copyright. The copyright attaches at that point. And she had done that, and she had posted the image to her site, and someone from Lil Kim's team had liked that photograph, had liked that imagery, and had basically copied it from her site and used it for their digital promotion of one of Lil Kim's singles.
We're lawyers, and we interview a lot of attorneys. Copyright can attach even though the creator did not file specific legal papers for that.
Yes, this is one of the primary misconceptions that we deal with when speaking with artists that have never been through the legal process before. There's no legal requirement to file anything in order for your copyright to attach. As I indicated before, it attaches at the moment of creation, at the moment the work is fixed. Now, registration is important because it's the key that unlocks the courthouse door. You can't file a lawsuit without a copyright registration, but your protection for your work is in no way limited if you do not file for a registration. Now, we encourage all of our artists to file registrations because if you have a registration that predates the infringement, predates the time at which someone uses your work without permission, you're able to recover statutory damages of up to $150,000 per work, and more importantly, you're able to recover your attorney's fees. And this is important in these cases, especially where you have a large corporation on the other side and you're an artist with potentially limited means. You haven't set aside a tranche of money to fund litigation. An example of this is a recent case that we took to trial against Urban Outfitters, the large retailer, where we tried the case to the jury. The jury unanimously found in favor of our artist and awarded us the maximum amount of damages available in that case, which was around $160,000, but the attorney's fees in that case were over $300,000. So luckily in that case, our client had been well advised and had registered their work before the infringement, so we were able to recover those fees. But in many other cases where the artist has not registered, it is often a deciding factor or a limiting factor in that artist's ability to bring their case in court.
Scott Burrows, can you talk to us about the limitations when it comes to art depicting the animal kingdom?
Yes, the animal kingdom or any naturally occurring flora or fauna can be the subject of protectable work. However, the protection that attaches to such a work is generally less robust than a more creative work. You can think of copyright protection as a spectrum, where the more fanciful the artwork is, the more baroque or creative the artwork is, the stronger the protection is that attaches. And the more general the artwork is, or to the extent that the artwork depicts something that's naturally occurring, you're going to have less protection. And this is important because once you're in a courtroom, the similarity that one has to show before a jury to prevail will be affected by the strength, the robustness of the protection. So an animal, if you have a design that depicts very naturalistically an animal, there's a famous case here in the Ninth Circuit where a sculptor created a jellyfish sculpture, and the court said, well, this is a naturally and very naturalistic jellyfish. We can't give you a monopoly or a copyright on this creation because that may preclude others from being able to create jellyfish. However, the certain creative embellishments and touches that you added to the naturalistic elements of a jellyfish, such as the way the tentacles curl, the angle at which it is depicted, those things are subject to copyright. So while anyone else can create jellyfish that look as jellyfish do in nature, your particular expression of the jellyfish is protected.
This is really interesting because this is the kind of stuff that we did not learn in law school.
Scott,
do you see companies or individuals who are repeat offenders?
Absolutely. There are certain companies that have a reputation for being involved in more lawsuits than others. I mentioned Urban Outfitters earlier. We've had a number of cases against Urban Outfitters. There are other retailers that, due to their business practices or their copyright policies, end up in more lawsuits than their competitors. Absolutely.
Now, we're very fond of the so-called Five Points case because it took place in New York, and we have a lot of graffiti or aerosol artists. And we had a recent decision in this case where a judge ruled that the artists were entitled to a multi-million dollar settlement. Can you explain what the artist had to do in this case to prevail? Their artwork was destroyed by a developer.
Absolutely. That case was fascinating because it addressed another distinction in U.S. copyright law as opposed to a lot of other countries, particularly European countries, where in the United States we generally don't have what are called moral rights or attribution rights, whereby an artist can protect the integrity of its artwork or ensure that the artwork's attributed to them, or to the extent that it's altered or modified without permission, not attributed to them. In Europe, it's the droit moral. Here, we don't have that same protection. But we do have a statute called VARA, which is the Visual Artist Rights Act. And what that says is that if a work has a certain stature in the industry, it cannot be destroyed or modified without the destroyer or modifier taking certain steps, such as alerting the artist and allowing them to take steps to protect the art or remove the art or do a number of other enumerated things. The Five Points case is interesting because the development at issue when this project started in an area that was not an extremely popular or valuable area in terms of real estate.
That was Long Island City in Queens, and these graffiti artists decorated a slum building out there, and then things changed.
Yeah, the developer invited these artists in and profited from the fact that this art made this development a tourist destination. People would come from around the world to look at the Five Points Project. But as Long Island City property values increased, the developer wanted to monetize the land, and he went about making and preparing to take down the project and put up luxury high-rises. The graffiti artist got wind of this and wanted to take steps to protect the art and protect the project to the extent possible. So they brought this case under VARA, indicating that these works were of a recognized stature and that they should not be destroyed, that they should be maintained. The developer in that case did himself no favors. While the case was pending, went out and whitewashed the artwork. Now, in the street art community, crossing out or whiting out someone else's artwork is basically the most disrespectful thing you can do. And the developer did this while the case was pending, while the judge was considering an order that would impact the artwork. And the court specifically identified this in the judgment as being one of the reasons why he awarded that large seven-figure sum. The court also identified, in a rare instance, the conduct of the developer himself during trial, including his testimony, including his behavior in connection with the court, questioning him using words like, you know, he was intransigent and he wouldn't answer questions as asked, and he didn't appear to have any contrition. And based partly on that, he awarded, you know, over $100,000 to many of the artists and awarded an aggregate judgment in the seven figures. You don't often see VARA cases go to trial. It's extremely rare. And you certainly don't see VAR cases that go to trial and result in a seven-figure verdict. But that's what happened in the Five Points case. And the judge specifically identified the developer's conduct, litigation conduct, as one of the reasons why the award was so high.
Yeah, he said that the guy was arrogant, and he hit him with a $6 million-plus judgment. And we had another example of this kind of arrogance with President Donald Trump, who built Trump Tower in the place where the wonderful department store Bonwit Teller on Fifth Avenue. And Bonwit Teller had these gorgeous Art Deco friezes on the building. And Trump destroyed those friezes. But he had previously promised to keep them and give them to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And he broke his promise, and he had them busted up with jackhammers. I wish that this judge could have got a hold of Donald Trump and punished him for his arrogance and philistinism.
Scott, quick question. Can you describe what it means for something to be in the public domain? And is that a defense that you come across in some of your cases?
So for a work to be in the public domain, it means that it's come out of copyright for whatever reason. It may have been a work that's so old that the copyright term has expired, or it may be a work that the artist dedicated to the public domain, which before 1976 would happen if an artist published something without the copyright notice, which is that little C that you will sometimes see on artwork in a circle. And if a work is in the public domain, it is, as the term suggests, open to the public. The public can use it and incorporate it in their work without permission of the artist and without any copyright concerns.
Scott, tell us about the Kariuvi Prince case.
Well, the Kariuvi Prince case is one that has been widely criticized by academics and judges since it was first issued back in, I believe, 2013. In that case, the photographer Kariu had spent a lot of time and money and artistic energy to create this amazing book called Yes, Rasta, which illustrated and portrayed a Rastafarian community. The photographs were striking and really amazing pieces of work. Richard Prince, the appropriation artist known for taking the work of others and monetizing it, saw the Yes, Rasta book and images from it, copied them, and then added non-artistic, superficial, goofy touches, such as putting a magazine cutout of a guitar in one of the gentleman's hands, putting splotches over the eyes of one of the gentlemen in the photograph. And he took these works and he marketed them under his Canal Zone project and realized millions and millions of dollars in sales. And the photographer took umbrage with the this misappropriation and brought the case in court. And the facts were not really disputed. There was no dispute that Richard Prince had accessed Carew's photographs. There's no dispute that he had copied them. There was no dispute that he had never obtained the consent of Carew. And there's no dispute that he had never paid Carew a dime in licensing. But on these facts, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is one step below the Supreme Court, found that Richard Prince's use of Carew's material was a, quote, fair use. And under the copyright law, fair use is a defense that allows someone to use someone else's work for purposes of education or criticism, for the most part, nonprofit uses. And Prince's use of Carew's material was very much for profit, millions of dollars in profit, in fact. But the court, citing some strange facts, such as Prince's fame and Prince's transformation of Carew's photographs, which again was adding a couple of splotches and some other superficial things, that was enough to preclude Carew the photographer from asserting any rights in his photographs vis-a-vis Prince's use and being entitled to any payment or percentage of the profits that Prince had made by exploiting Carew's photographs. Now, since that decision has come out, it's been, as I indicated earlier, criticized for straying from the statute. The Copyright Act has specific elements that the court should look at when deciding fair use, and the Carew court went well beyond those. And for overlooking the effect on the market, which is one of the most important, or should be the most important, fair use factor, which the idea there being that when you're looking at fair use, the most important thing you should look at is how does this affect the market for the work that's being used in the way that's allegedly fair. Here, there were photographs. Carew was a professional photograph. He made money by selling and licensing his photographs. When someone comes along and takes your photographs without licensing them from you and uses them in a for-profit venture, such as Prince's Canal Zone project, that's the very type of use that should almost never be fair. However, the court found fair use, and that decision has now been walked back in a series of other also interesting decisions, such as a case where the Who's On First bit was incorporated into a play that the court found was not fair use and began limiting Carew in that case. And since then, the pendulum is swinging back now to a more fair use analysis. But it all began with that Carew decision back in 2013.
Scott, I'm so sad to say that we're running out of time because this is one of the most fascinating segments we've done. I'm curious, do you teach this?
We do lecture for various artist rights organizations. Our firm is a primarily artist side firm, so we only represent artists, content creators, musicians, animators, visual artists, graphic artists, writers. We're on the side of content. So to the extent that we can lecture for companies like or organizations like California Lawyers for the Arts, the Fashion Business Institute, we lecture at the local law schools here in Los Angeles, getting the word out about artists' rights and how important they are in this age of content. I mean, we're in a position now where we read more and view more pictures and consume more content than ever before. But the artists are in a position where they're getting paid less and less as things like music and photography get devalued by the internet.
Right. Scott, how can listeners learn more about your law firm and your work?
They can visit our website at www.donegerlawfirm.com. They can view our Instagram account at veniceartlaw.com. Or they can read my copyright and art law columns, which appear every Wednesday on abovethelaw.com.
Scott Burrows, it's really been a pleasure to have you on, and hopefully we'll get to talk again in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Scott. Take it easy. If
you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.